Brought to you by the law offices of E. Chase and Blankenship. With the All Big Ten teams being announced the day of this recording, yesterday most likely when you are listening to this, and the conference tournament finalized, it's time to get into that. And for that, we have a special guest today. Joining me on the phone is Alex Cook. So without further ado, let's get on over to our discussion of the awards, the conference tournament, Michigan's outlook, and also us answering a few mailbag questions. All right, we welcome in the grand villain himself, my former Not Just a Shooter partner, Alex Cook. How you doing, man?
Good, good. Getting ready for some March Madness.
Yeah, it is that time of year. We just got earlier this evening, at least as of the time that we're recording this, the All Big Ten teams were released and the various awards and whatnot, and we are going to mostly agree with them, I think, actually, but we'll see if we get into any arguments.
I'm pretty sure I went with the media team, except for like maybe one player differently. So yeah, I guess I'm just going with the flow there.
Yeah, same here. I had the media team, so might as well put that out there. That media picked Cassius Winston, Ayo Dosunmu, Lamar Stevens, Jalen Stick-Smith, and Luka Garza, who was the player of the year for both coaches and the media too, which I also don't think is going to get much argument. The coaches replaced Ayo Dosunmu with Maryland's Anthony Cowan. So I had Winston, Dosunmu, Stevens, Sticks, and Garza. Who did you have on your first team?
I had the same. I think, I guess, part of me wanted to go with Oturu on the first team. I think he had a great season, but ultimately Minnesota's lack of team success kind of held him back, in my opinion. I also am not really a stickler for this has to be a functional lineup theory in terms of picking an all-conference team, which I know is a big point of contention among the MGO staff. So I will say that. Right. Well, he gets to make the rules, so
that's true.
But I feel like, I don't know, you could go with 10 or 11 centers almost on the top three teams this year, and you know, you might go without any wings given the distribution of talent in the league.
Yeah, that was definitely the most difficult part for me. Is, I mean, it's certainly nice that Ayo is 6'5 and can legitimately defend wings, so that at least made shooting guard a little bit less of a mess, but I tried to stick to more closely to lineups that you could conceivably field. And as we get into the second and third teams, I think we'll see a bit of deviation between the two of us because of that. And
yeah, and
that's totally down to philosophy, because it was obviously an amazing year for centers in the conference. It was an okay year for point guards, and it was a downright bad year for wings.
Right. Can we talk about Luka Garza for a second? Because, man, I cannot believe how good he's been. I'm just shocked.
It blows my mind that he's a legitimate 26-point-per-game scorer in the Big Ten. He's almost putting up a double-double every day. I mean, if you had told me that the conference would be stocked at center this year and that I'd have Luka Garza as my first-team center, you would have been able to knock me over with a feather, because he's just he's not good at defense, and that is so important for a center, but he's such a good offensive player this year that he overcomes that for me.
So productive. And yeah, it's interesting. I haven't really watched enough college basketball to have an informed opinion between he and Obi Toppin for National Player of the Year, but that he's even in the conversation is just ridiculous. To your point about his lack of defense, Iowa is the most Iowa possible team this year, even without Jordan Bohannon. They have the best offense in the Big Ten by a mile, right up there with Nebraska and Northwestern for worst defense. And yeah, Eyebrows Mo is just at the middle of it I don't know, getting rebounds, scoring 20 points a night. It's pretty crazy. He's a huge reason why they've been able to kind of withstand all the injuries they've had this year.
Yeah, looking up and down that roster before the season, and I had an inkling that Jordan Bohannon's season was going to go the way it goes because we had seen a similar situation with Spike Albrecht. And,
right.
When I looked at that team preseason, I thought bubble team out. That I'm pretty sure that's where I had them.
Yeah, I didn't
this year.
Me neither.
So that was. I mean, and that is mostly Garza just being such an offensive force that he has lifted the rest of that team along, because they really have no right to be a top 10 offense.
Right. And I guess before we move on from the first team, I do kind of want to touch on Lamar Stevens, because I think it's interesting the role he plays for them, which is a not that efficient but high usage player, is super valuable to that team. And, you know, you look at Penn State, in terms of Big Ten teams, they're not super high in KenPom. Who knows if they get bounced out of the first round of the tournament. But I think part of the reason they have been so good is because Stevens does shoulder such a burden for them offensively, even if, you know, you look at, okay, well, his offensive rating is this. It doesn't really matter, just because I don't know how many players can take that many shots and how many more roles are more manageable for the rest of the players given what he does on offense for them.
Yeah, I mean, your offense isn't going to have the highest ceiling when Lamar Stevens is your go-to player, but he gives you a really solid floor, because he can eat up 30% of your possessions and produce about a point per possession out of it. And when you're Penn State and you play, you know, legitimate top 25 defense, even though they fell off a little bit in Big Ten play, I mean, that was still enough to get them. I mean, they're easily going to make the tournament, which is not something you can really ever say about Penn State. And they had a winning record in the toughest Big Ten since 2013. So, yeah. I mean, just because his KenPom page doesn't look super pretty, I think you have to look at the outcomes and also how much of a mess that team is if he ever leaves the court.
Yeah, I think his presence allows them to play guys like Wheeler and Herrer more too. Herrer. And yeah, they have quite a few guys who are mostly just shooters, and yeah, Lamar Stevens is propping them up. I'm pretty shocked. I was not really buying the hype on Penn State this year, but I guess credit to Pat Chambers. It finally all came together. I do wonder if Tony Carr hadn't left for the pros 2 years ago and he had stuck around, been a four-year player, which kind of unlikely what they would look like. But I don't know. Stevens is an all-time great for them, one of their best ever players, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he's been the best player on some of their best ever teams. So I think Penn State fans probably have a better read on how good Lamar Stevens is than a lot of more casual fans who are, you know, look at him seeing, you know, look at him putting up 26% from three and not being particularly efficient from two and going, why do people like this guy? But when you watch him night in and night out, first of all, he plays really great defense and he can guard across pretty much every position on the floor. And he just keeps that offense grinding out possessions, and that his mid-range game is legitimately excellent. That's an often overlooked thing. So just because people might be a little down because Penn State had a rough close to the season, but I think right. If you look at the full body of work, Stevens was one of the easiest picks for me because of how bad the situation is on the wing this year.
Agreed. Yeah, and I think too, before we move on to the next, you know, couple players, I do think that ISO ball has some redeeming value in terms of turnover mitigation. Penn State doesn't really turn it over much because they just kind of give it to Stevens and let him work from his spots. Is there anybody else on the first team that you kind of want to go into detail before we move into the second team?
I mean, we can, you know, I think Cassius Winston was a very obvious choice. I don't know if there's too much that needs to be said about him. Jalen Smith was also a relatively easy choice because he was one of the – I was trying to stick a little bit to positions, and that allowed me to have a four-man who's actually played the four, even though obviously a big reason he's broken out is that he's been able to play the five without Bruno Fernando kind of clogging things up down there.
Yeah, I kind of went back and forth on Smith and then the centers that I have on my second team. Just because, I mean, Xavier Tillman, great player. Oturu, maybe the best pro prospect in the league. I know Io's up there. Then Caleb Wesson, he's had a great year. All three of those are on my second team. But yeah, to your point, Smith has really excelled at center, and I think kind of underrated is the fact that the Mitchell twins transferred out towards the beginning of the season, and they have no depth up front. So having him out there as often as he is competing against these other, you know, pretty elite centers, I think he's a, you know, perfectly good choice for the first team.
Yeah, I mean, kind of a basketball mantra is that one of the best abilities is availability, and at few positions is that more, no position is that more true than center. And you know,
especially in college.
Yeah, I mean, Michigan fans know once you get to the backup center, it gets dicey. So yeah, when I was putting together the Maryland preview this week, and I was kind of looking at his game by game stats just to see, is there a chance that maybe Michigan can get him into some foul trouble and kind of test the complete lack of depth they have up front? He's only fouled out of one game this year, and he's only had four fouls three different times. So he stays on the floor as long as he wants. He's got a high motor along with that. Like in the Michigan Maryland game, I think all of his offensive rebounds came in the second half. And he's such an active defender. He was comparably good to Oturu, and he was on a better team, and he's a little bit more versatile positionally. So that was what gave him the edge to me. Over, I mean, like you said, was a really tough choice among big men.
Yeah, I mean, who are your top 10 centers in the league? Like, we don't have to go down the list, but even as you're getting towards the bottom of that, you got Rovers, Micah Potter, Jackson Davis, Coburn, Teske. It really was a good year for big men in the Big Ten.
Yeah, it was absurd. So let's on that note, you've already mentioned three big men on your second team.
Yep.
The official second team also had three big men. Both the coaches and media had Tillman, Caleb Wesson, and Oturu up front, and Xavier Simpson at point guard. And they had whichever one of Io Desunmu or Anthony Cowan wasn't on their first team. So before we get into the big men, we haven't discussed Anthony Cowan's season yet, and he's another guy who is a little bit of a higher usage, not the greatest efficiency, at least in terms of shooting. He was low turnover, which is really impressive given the load that he handled. But he's another guy where I think once you got down and watched the games and saw, particularly with him, the degree of difficulty of the shots that he had to take on in Mark Turgeon's five-play offense. So I think he comes off even better than the numbers show.
Yeah, and in the interest of full disclosure, this is the first season that I haven't written about Big Ten basketball since, I want to say, 2010. So I have not watched as much as I usually do, but I have seen, you know, quite a few Maryland games. And I think important context for him is people expected Ayala and Wiggins to step up as sophomores. You know, they're really promising as freshmen. They've kind of underwhelmed, you know, results Sunday's game notwithstanding. And you look at it, senior point guard, Big Ten championship, and yeah, just he is kind of the beginning and the end of their offense. So yeah, I'm totally comfortable having him on the second team. I think I would have him over Xavier Simpson, who I also have on the second team, if I had to rank them. But you know, Simpson also had a strong season. I think for him, you know, less impactful defensively, maybe. Like, I know in the second Michigan State game, Howard switched Brooks onto Winston for much of that game. I think a lot of that has to do with like energy conservation, you know, with how
absolutely
much he handles on offense. But yeah, Xavier Simpson, Anthony Cowan, Tillman, Wesson, Oturu. That's what I have on my second team.
So you are in lockstep with the media through your first and second teams. I tried to stick a little bit more positionally, and once again came out with something a little different this time. I did not the first time. Like you said, I would probably have Cowan above Simpson if I had to split hairs here, but since Cowan is a viable player off the ball, I have them both on my second team. I looked for a wing here, so I have Joe Wieskamp from Iowa on my second team. He had kind of a rough start to the season, but he's another just offensive force on a team with a really good offense. He's Iowa's easily their best perimeter-oriented threat on a team that's pretty dangerous from out there. I put Micah Potter on my second team at power forward, which I know is a little interesting, but I think Michigan fans might agree with that after watching Michigan's loss to Wisconsin. To me, he was the difference in Wisconsin totally turning around their season and becoming kind of out of nowhere a co-champion of this really difficult conference. And I thought he was better than Reavers. He ended up playing less this season, but he was so... And I tried to take into account the fact that he didn't play nearly as much as a lot of the other guys, but to me, he was over 50% and over on twos, over 40% on threes, and had as big a defensive impact as a lot of the other top tier centers in the league. So I ended up kind of shoehorning him at the four, and then Daniel Autry was my five.
It's interesting that you would pick Potter over Tillman. I like the argument that Potter has been the difference for Wisconsin. I think you look at their mediocre non-conference showing. If he had been eligible before the start of the winter semester, I don't think Wisconsin would have suffered as much. And I do agree that he's better than Reavers. But yeah, Xavier Tillman, I have him on my second team. I think he is maybe the most unsung player in the conference. I feel like most people who pay like reasonably close attention know how impactful he is, but Michigan State's defense kind of falls apart with him without him out there, and he does so many of the little things that I definitely think that he merits inclusion on the second team.
Yeah, he was definitely the toughest cut for me, and I ended up with him. I mean, he's my defensive player of the year. He was the conference's defensive player of the year. But I just, to me, the difference was that Potter was able to add some stretch, and Tillman just was more up and down on offense in ways that really impacted State's record.
Right.
And that might be unfair that a few games are sticking out for his offense, especially since, I mean, when we get to talking about all defense guys, his close to the season on defense was outrageous in terms of who he went up against and what he held them to.
Yeah, so his performance against Lamar Stevens a couple games ago was really impressive, because you would think Tillman, you know, traditionally a center, would have maybe a more difficult time guarding a wing that can kind of stretch it out to 18 feet, but he did great in that game. It was a big reason why they came back and won.
Yeah, I mean, that was absolutely a defensive player of the year showcase for him, was coming out and defending, you know, a guy who's a power forward who, you know, plays a serious off the dribble game, and
yeah,
to be able to stick with him like he did was probably the best single game defensive performance of the season.
Definitely,
at least if you're going by degree of difficulty.
Yep,
that's outrageous.
And before we move on from the second team, I would like to say it's kind of a shame that Daniel Oturu won't be playing in the NCAA tournament. He has been great. I think you can kind of say the same for Marcus Carr, who I did not have on my third team, and who definitely gets the honorable mention designation. But I knew that the Big Ten wasn't going to get 12 teams in, right? Like, Northwestern and Nebraska couldn't suck up that many losses. And I guess it does make sense that Minnesota would be kind of the odd man out. But they're still top 30 in KenPom, even with a losing record, and they just have suffered so many close losses that, you know, Oturu is in the top 10 for KenPom Player of the Year, and I don't think it's unfair to put him on the second team because there are so many good bigs, and Minnesota has 14 wins.
Yeah, I would say some of that's probably bad luck, and some of that is probably an indictment of Richard Pitino's late game offense.
Oh, Richard Pitino, the mastermind? I don't
Did
know.
Did he call another high pick and roll?
Oh, man. Do you think he could
timeout? Out
of timeout? Oh, man. Yeah. I don't know. Shoot, John Beilein from Minnesota?
That would probably add 5 or 6 wins to that team. So I would prefer not. But we'll get to that in the mailbag section of this podcast. So before we burn too much more time, you mentioned Carr. He's on my third team. He was also on the media's third team. This is where things kind of split a little bit. The media had Marcus Carr, Joe Wieskamp, Indiana's Trace Jackson Davis, Nate Reavers, and Illinois' Kofi Coburn. The coaches had Demetric Trice from Wisconsin, Geo Baker from Rutgers, Wieskamp, Jackson Davis, and Reavers. I was kind of surprised to see Reavers, out of all the big men in this conference, get love from both the coaches and media. I did not have him on my third team. I tried to stick more positionally again, so I had Carr at shooting guard. I had Andre Wesson, who wasn't, he played more of a role player's style, but he did it very efficiently. He was kind of the guy who held that team together in a lot of ways, in my opinion, and played really great defense all season. And then I had Ron Harper Jr. from Rutgers, who is actually a wing and scored pretty well for them. Did it in a very difficult offensive environment and was part of a really salty defense on a good team. And then I had Jackson Davis and Tillman rounding out my third team.
Okay. Yeah, I had Trice, Wieskamp, Potter, Jackson Davis, and Coburn. And honestly, I don't really have strong takes on any of them. You could argue other people ahead of each of them probably. And yeah, you know, it's best conference in the country for college basketball this year, despite having no wings. And once you get to the third team and the honorable mention section, I think you could make a case for a lot of different guys.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure if I looked back over it tomorrow, I might have a completely different guard rotation on that team. It was kind of difficult to pick through it. I almost ended up with Franz Wagner on my third team. And while I think Franz was quite good for a freshman, it was weird to have him in consideration for all Big Ten at this point. But that tells you how thin things were on the wings this year.
I will say that I picked Trice over Carr just because of the team success. So Wisconsin, you know, surprise, Big Ten championship, Minnesota finished 12th. So I guess that was the difference for me.
Yeah, I think that's probably why I had Potter as high as I did. I think that was kind of to represent Wisconsin's team success.
Yeah. The thing about Wisconsin is, though, I mean, let's see, they are 22nd in KenPom pending tonight's games. They did well in conference play relative to non-conference, so that's part of it. But, like, I don't think that they are much better than a lot of teams in the Big Ten. Like, I don't know that I would even put them in the top three.
No, I mean, there's kind of a huge pile after Michigan State in terms of efficiency margin in conference play. State, quite frankly, was the best team in the conference and got kind of unlucky in terms of how things shook out. I'm not a huge Wisconsin believer to the point that I felt like I had to get multiple guys into my All Big Ten list. And also, I think we have a bit of a departure here. I chose Rutgers' Steve Peichel as my coach of the year. The Big Ten went with Greg Gard from Wisconsin, and I believe you did as well.
I did, yes. I wasn't happy about it. And real quickly before we get to that, Michigan State is the best team in the conference, but let's just remember that they are falling short of their very, very lofty preseason expectations, and that will likely be the case at the end of the year. I did pick Gard.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm willing to get those takes out there that Michigan State's a crushing disappointment because they aren't an overwhelmingly dominant team. But yeah, that's just me. I picked guard. I felt like the way that the whole Kobe King transfer went down was pretty suspect. Having Andy Katz go on the Big Ten Network and basically, I mean, he wasn't slandering the guy, but like pretty critical of a player who, and I mean, again, we don't know the story at all. And I guess, shoot, the results after he left may have indicated that it might have been a good thing for both parties. But the way that that was all handled makes me pretty uncomfortable with guard. And there are so many good candidates for Coach of the Year, like Chambers, Underwood, Pikel. You can go Fran McCaffrey. But I look at the fact that they managed to win the Big Ten despite losing their top scorer in January to a transfer. To me, that's pretty impressive. And I know Wisconsin has a degree of inertia where, like, I'll believe it when I see it when they suck. But they lost their best player for the last, you know, 3-4 years in Ethan Happ, and nobody predicted them to be any good. And there they are at the top of the standings at the end of the year. So that's why I picked Greg Gard.
Yeah, for me, I just I have been impressed with how he handled things after losing King. But I don't want to give him too much credit when it really does seem like he was largely responsible. I mean, he and the coaching staff that he put together seem largely responsible for chasing King off. And also, like, while they lost King, they did gain Micah Potter partway through the season.
True.
Kind of gave them an entire new identity. Now, you have to credit guard for being able to incorporate a guy who totally changed how they played partway through the season. But for me, Pikel, I mean, they also had an unexpected departure. It just happened during the off season. When they lost their leading scorer and rebounder, Amoruri.
Yeah, Amoruri was like the heart and soul of their team, and I was convinced that Rutgers would have a tough go of it. I still don't really understand how they're any good. I think they're just the most Big Ten team possible, where they play defense and rebound and have Geo Baker go Kobe mode, even though he's like pretty average, maybe.
Which is why I think Pikel is Coach of the Year, is because I don't really understand their success outside the context of they're really well coached and play super hard. And they're not, I mean, really well coached mostly on defense. You know, they do not run beautiful offense by any sense, but they also, based on the kind of like the guys that you have to take if you're Rutgers, you know, they've recruited a type. And that type is physical and energetic and going to play really, really hard, especially on defense. And, you know, it's a bonus if they have basketball skills.
Yeah, you going off on that kind of explanation makes me think of the Big Ten Network announcers back when Penn State was not any good. Under Pat Chambers, they would always be like, oh, they're really giving great effort out there, and you see how hard those kids are playing defense, and you know that they're just really bought into Coach Chambers and his system. It's like those Penn State teams sucked, but this Rutgers team is actually pretty good. So maybe those platitudes can be translated here.
Yeah, it's a difficult year to pick Coach of the Year, so I don't think you could really go wrong with either guard or Pikel.
What about Chris Collins?
You know, he's got a lot of young guys out there.
It was a really young team this year. Year 7, I think.
And
whatever.
Got a signature win on senior day.
Very happy for him. I could not be a bigger fan of that program under Chris Collins.
It hasn't been lovely at all to watch them totally fall in the tank. So quickly, just the rest of the awards. Obviously, I think everybody agrees on Luka Garza as the Big Ten Player of the Year.
Yep.
Defensive Player of the Year and Sixth Man were things that only the coaches picked for some reason. And they picked Aaron Wiggins for Sixth Man of the Year. I think his quote was, "I am really surprised." I was too. I mean, he's all right for Maryland, but he doesn't even stand out for me among a rather underwhelming group of wings this year. And meanwhile, Micah Potter was on my, he was on my second team all conference, and he comes off the bench.
Yeah, that's a pretty insane choice. As for Micah Potter in Wisconsin, they really pull off the two center look. Like, their two best players are center, arguably, better than Purdue does. And they can actually work together, which is nice. Potter is my sixth man of the year. Incredibly obvious choice. I don't know how you could pick someone else. And then, yeah, defensive player of the year. I don't know how you could argue anybody else other than Tillman. I don't even know where I would start there.
No argument here. I assume very little argument on Kofi Coburn as freshman of the year, although Trace Jackson Davis has an argument there too.
Yeah, I'll put on my homer hat and say that if Franz had been here all summer and hadn't gotten hurt before the season started, that he would be up there. I think he's a pretty strong candidate for breakout player next year in the Big Ten, but Coburn would be my choice too. He has transformed that entire team in so many ways, more so than just, hey, it's a really huge guy who's really good at basketball.
Yeah, speaking of, coaches have done a great job this year. Brad Underwood totally changed how they played defense, and that has been very successful. And some of that has been Coburn being 7 feet, 290 pounds, even though he's not a stellar shot blocker yet. Size is intimidating. So they managed to field a solid defense, even though they've got Coburn and Georgi Pajanasvili up front.
Yeah, he doesn't have Coburn hedging screens 35 feet from the basket, so it's a pretty good strategy.
Yeah, that's probably the right call. So before we move on to the next segment, which is our Big Ten tournament preview, any last thoughts on, like, major departures from where the coaches and media went? I mean, the only thing to me is, like, I didn't think Nate Reavers was as good as Micah Potter, and they thought otherwise. I left Caleb Wesson off of all of my teams because his numbers really dropped off in Big Ten play. He was much better defensively than he was last year, but I didn't think the team success necessitated a second team choice, and I thought his offensive production wasn't enough to get him above the other centers. Those were kind of my only major bones to pick because, like we discussed, it was tough to assemble a third team.
Yeah, I don't have any major disagreements there. I did have Wesson on my second team, but, you know, his numbers did fall off. I think that he's been more effective this year in some ways and less effective than others. But ultimately, he's Ohio State's best player and their, you know, top 10 team in KenPom. I'm comfortable with him on the second team. I don't really have any gripes. It's not like they left Xavier Simpson off of the all defense team, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Did they?
You know, they did, and I don't know if I hate it.
Yeah, I don't.
Those are the two things I've actually forgotten to mention before we move on again. Quickly, the all defense team from the Big Ten is Nojel Eastern, Jamari Wheeler from Penn State, Xavier Tillman, Stick Smith, and Daniel Altuer. That is not a lineup you can actually put out there. So mine is different. I had Wheeler because I have no idea why else Penn State could justify playing him if he wasn't an all-Big Ten level defender. He just doesn't do much of anything on offense. And he's played, when I've watched him, he's played really excellent defense this year. If I had to pick who's the better defender between Wheeler and Xavier Simpson, I would probably pick Simpson. But in terms of who had the better season, Wheeler got to devote all his energy to defense. Simpson didn't, and frequently down the stretch of the season got moved kind of off the primary threat. So I think that hurt his candidacy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm fine with the all defense team that they chose. I don't really have any gripes.
I put I pulled Oturu out of there, which feels insane. But I think Jalen Smith is an incredible defender, and I think Xavier Tillman is an even better defender. And I wanted a team that you could actually put on the court. So I put Luther Muhammad out there. He's been really excellent for Ohio State. He's really physical, but he moves incredibly well for a guy who's kind of built like a barrel. It really stood out to me in Michigan's games against them. A lot of times they put him on Xavier Simpson, and he was great at working his way around screens.
Yeah, I think he's probably the best or second best wing defender in the conference. Defensive stopper. I think you look at guys like Eastern and Daryl Morsell there too. But yeah, Muhammad, he's been pretty good.
Yeah, those other two that you mentioned, I mean, I had Eastern on my team, and he also made the Big Tens, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And Morsell, it was a tough cut. And then for the Big Tens all-freshman team, they had Michigan State's Rocket Watts, Iowa's C.J. Frederick, Franz Wagner, Trace Dance, Jax Davis, and Kofi Coburn. I had the same thing. Zero gripes here. I will only mention that had he not taken leave, DJ Carton would absolutely have been the point guard on this team.
Yep. Yeah, I did not create an all-freshman team, but I'll just go with that one. Sounds good to me.
There was a pretty big drop-off after those guys. And even Rocket Watts needed a pretty good close to the season to kind of work his way into being an obvious choice with Carton out.
Yeah,
but he really finished the season well. I think he's going to be an excellent player next year, much to our dismay.
It'll be real interesting to see how he continues to mesh with Izzo as his career progresses.
It's always interesting to see how talented players mesh with Izzo as their careers progress.
Talented players with that style of play too. Like if you're a talented player, like say Nick Ward. I mean, Izzo and he had a contentious relationship regardless, but, you know, the microwave guard who loves to take step-back threes, I'm sure that just drives Izzo crazy.
Yeah, I'm sure we're going to get some good gifts out of it. I look forward to those. And on that note, we're going to take a quick break, come back, and preview the Big Ten tournament with a focus on Michigan's path. When your plumbing breaks, you hire someone who knows how to fix plumbing. When your power goes out, you hire an electrician. When you are injured in an accident, you should hire someone with experience. Jason Blankenship, a Michigan law graduate, has over 20 years of litigation experience to help you. Jason has handled matters and venues across the state and country, from various circuit courts across the state through the Michigan Supreme Court and the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. Jason's experience in both federal and state courts makes him able to handle your complicated personal injury case. Before starting his own firm in 2014, Jason worked at a large plaintiff's firm, but he left in order to give his clients the personal attention you and your case deserve. Jason selects each case personally, and you will deal directly with Jason to resolve your case. The insurance companies have teams of lawyers on their side. You should have someone on your side, too. Call 248-533-0516. That's 248-533-0516. Or email Jason at BlankenshipLawyer.com. Michigan enters the Big Ten tournament as the 9 seed. Not that it really mattered too much how the 8 versus 9 thing shook out. They were locked into that game heading into the Maryland game, which may have impacted how they played in that Maryland game. I'm not sure. But Michigan is the 9 seed. They will face 8-seeded Rutgers at noon on Thursday. Michigan has already beaten Rutgers twice this season. Notably, neither of those games were at Chrysler. So you know, Michigan already has a neutral court win over Rutgers and a road win over Rutgers, the only road win over Rutgers that anyone had this season. I think this was about as good a matchup as you could hope for, given where Michigan finished in this conference.
I think so. I think Rutgers is a team that Michigan can kind of shut down defensively for the most part. Rutgers didn't top a point per possession and didn't really come that close in either of the matchups. It's worth noting that in the Madison Square Garden game, Michigan was without Isaiah Livers and still won. Easily the best win that they had without Livers, in my opinion. And yeah, in terms of you know, the noon Big Ten tournament game, Michigan Rutgers, I think that's a pretty good matchup for U of M.
Yeah, it's when you go and look at the home versus away neutral splits for Rutgers, I think they're more dramatic than any other Big Ten team. They're when they go away from home, first of all, they're 2-10 this season when they're not at the rack. They have the 94th ranked offense, which is a bit of a drop-off from where they are normally, not a huge one. The significant drop-off is they go all the way down to the number 50 defense. And almost literally all of their best performances have come at home. They actually haven't surpassed a 90 game score away from home, if you're familiar with the Bart Torvik stat. They did that twice in their two wins, but it has otherwise been pretty rough. I don't know why Rutgers is so much better at defense at home, but it's nice to catch them away from it.
Yeah, I will say that MGO favorite Jacob Young, who I actually unironically like because of how he plays. I feel like
he plays really hard.
College basketball player, yeah, really high energy, disruptive defensive guard who just can't really do offense unless he's in transition. That really sums it up for me for Rutgers. Like, I feel like he's the perfect avatar of them in a way. Geo Baker has had plenty of clutch moments. You look at his shooting percentages and overall efficiency, and it doesn't look great, but he kind of has that Kobe Bryant, I'm going to take the shot, I have that mentality, and it served Rutgers well, I guess, you know.
And he's kind of got the thing that would, like, how we discussed with Lamar Stevens, where when you're on a bad offense, just by taking on a certain amount of usage and not being terrible with it, you're providing something pretty valuable.
Yeah, and then you look at kind of the rest of their roster. On the wings, you have Harper, Yeboah, and Mathis. They're all pretty defensively oriented players. And then Miles Johnson in the paint, another defensively oriented player who's good on the offensive glass, but not super impactful otherwise on that side of the floor. And yeah, you know, I think it's a game that'll get ugly for Michigan. I do think that Michigan's ball screen offense had some success in both matchups against Rutgers, which bodes well for the rematch. I don't really buy the whole it's hard to beat a team three times thing. I don't think that makes a whole lot of sense.
I believe that's been disproven statistically too. So, yeah, I do not buy that whole thing either. I think it's easier to beat teams that you've already beaten twice because that tends to indicate that you're better than them.
I guess my main question for this game is how, like, what percentage of our listeners do you think will be streaming this at work?
Oh, I would assume north of 75. Also, we got to ask, will anybody actually be at work by the end of this week? Because, I mean, I work from home, so this isn't impacting my life yet, but things are getting interesting very quickly with the coronavirus stuff.
Yeah, I think it's just going to kind of hit us after, like, the realization of what's happening will hit us, like, 2 weeks after we kind of have crossed the point of no return. So, looking forward to that. Every time I go to the gym, I think about it. I'm like, man, this place is nasty. I'm probably picking up corona.
Yeah, we should move on very quickly because I am definitely scared every time I leave the house right now. If Michigan gets past Rutgers and I'm assuming we both think there's a better than 50-50 chance that that would happen. Michigan gets a rematch with number one seed Wisconsin, which is a wild thing to say.
I do think it's north of 50-50 that Michigan beats Rutgers, but I don't think it's that much north of 50-50. KenPom has it at 56 right now. I'd put it maybe around 60% chance. But yes, assuming that the Wolverines defeat the Scarlet Knights, they will be facing the wonderful Wisconsin Badgers, our favorite program in the conference.
Yeah. And unfortunately, the last time Michigan played Wisconsin, it did not go particularly well. The good thing is Michigan eventually made the adjustment that they needed to make to win that game. They just did it after 30 minutes had elapsed. So if Michigan makes this game, you have to hope that given the presence of, no matter whether it's Potter or Reavers, you're going to have a stretch five out there. This is not a game where Austin Davis is playable. This is a game where Brandon Johns is your backup center.
You know, I think a bigger reason for the first loss was just the horrible defensive communication with the ginormous lineup that Michigan was running out there with Wagner at the two, Livers at the three, Johns at the four, which won't be a problem this time. I think just having Brooks back in the lineup helps Michigan a lot. Wisconsin also, and this was mostly Demetric Kreis and mostly on good looks, but they shot really, really well from three-point range in the first game. And I think that'll be a big bellwether in the rematch is who is shooting more threes. I know Michigan likes to take away threes. Wisconsin is the same way. And in the first matchup, Wisconsin shot twice as many in addition to hitting them at 48%. So, yeah, I think a lot of that does come down to playing Johns at the five. I don't think you can get away with playing him the whole game there, even.
Oh, no, I still think you need Teske as your starting center, logging 20-something minutes at least, because he's okay enough staying with those guys, because neither Reavers or Potter is like an absolute. Potter's better than Reavers at hitting more contested shots. Neither of them is an absolute killer from three-point range, as long as you can pose some sort of contest to him. But Austin Davis in drop coverage, or really any sort of pick-and-roll coverage, is just not mobile enough to get out on those guys and maintain a sound defense. Your mention of the three-point totals from last game, I do think Wisconsin is also going to have to change the way they play defense from the first game, because while they did hold Michigan to 10 three-point attempts, they did it by playing such extreme no-help defense that Xavier Simpson went 9 for 13 at the rim and put up an O rating of a 131, personally. So if Michigan shoots reasonably well and gets – this was not a decent game from Isaiah Livers, but if they get an even halfway decent game out of him, I don't think that strategy pays off at all. It did not seem like a sustainable way to stop Michigan, which is why other teams have not tried it.
Yeah, they just let Simpson get his and score 30 and try to shut down everybody else strategy. That would not be how I would approach playing Michigan, and it did wind up working because they played so well offensively. But, you know, theoretically, Michigan just over 1.1 points per possession in that loss in Chrysler. Like, you think that offensive output is good enough to win most games at home. Didn't win that one, but yeah, to your point, I don't think they're going to let Simpson score 30 again. I do think it's worth noting that in any advanced ranking of choice, Michigan is ahead of Wisconsin, even though they're way below in the standings. So got to assume that the Wolverines will be favorites if they make it that far. But I don't know.
They probably won't be betting favorites.
You don't think so?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think with the way Wisconsin closed the season and the fact that they beat Michigan on the road, there will be enough public support to swing that line.
That's a good point.
But I wouldn't, you know, if they were betting favorites, I wouldn't necessarily recommend against betting on Michigan. Even though it's not the ideal matchup for this team, honestly, if you're picking one of the co-champs to play, that's probably the one I'd pick.
Yeah, I think they're the worst of the three, and the stretch five thing can give Michigan problems, but I think that's true of most teams. Like, you know, once you start getting into the backup bigs, I don't think they're guarding the pick and pop that well. And, you know, Reavers and Potter don't really have the Mo thing where they can pick and pop and then create if, you know, against a hard closeout or anything. So as long as that can be guarded decently well, I think Michigan has a pretty good chance. Trice also played the game of his life against Michigan in the first game, and
he can't five out of his six threes. Like, that's not going to happen again in all likelihood.
And I just remember thinking after that game, like, I wasn't too mad or upset about it. It was just Wisconsin played really damn well in that game, and sometimes that just happens, you know, especially when you're in a conference where there's 10 or 11 or 12 good teams. Michigan caught Wisconsin's best shot that night, and if they catch Wisconsin's best shot again on Friday, they'll probably lose, but I would expect more of a, you know, average performance, in which case, you know, Michigan's got a good chance to advance to the semifinals.
Yeah, and then we should talk about kind of who we'd prefer to see should Michigan get that far. I don't think either of us are expecting Minnesota or Northwestern to advance very far through the top of the bracket on Michigan's side, which leaves Iowa and Illinois, who both bring their strengths and weaknesses, shall we say, to the table. They are very different teams, that's for sure. I would rather play Illinois just to avoid the potential monster game from Luka Garza potential. Though you could also say that Iowa would, in that case, be playing their third game in 3 days, whereas Illinois gets the double bye. So there might be some advantage to catching the more tired team. Iowa just has such an explosive offense that I prefer to avoid that.
Yeah, I know that you asked me to think this over before we started the podcast, and I hadn't given it much thought, which I apologize. But my gut says that I would rather Michigan play Iowa, if only because, yeah, Garza could score 30 or maybe 40, who knows. But shoot, I would expect Michigan up-tempo game. And yeah, I mean, Michigan's offense against Iowa's defense is really an appealing matchup, in my opinion, just because they really are one of the worst defensive teams in the conference.
Yeah, I mean, Michigan did score 103 on them in the Chrysler game. So I think Michigan actually got pretty fortunate in terms of how the bracket shook out, because I don't mind hitting either of those teams. Whereas, you know, having Michigan State and Maryland both on the other side of the bracket, that was a nice break, I think, for Michigan.
Yeah. I will say for Illinois, they swept Michigan during the regular season. But I don't really see it with them. I think Io is a great player, Coburn, Georgie, yeah, to your point, I would rather face Illinois or Iowa than Maryland or Michigan State or even Ohio State.
Yeah, and I believe, you know, in the game at Chrysler, they won on a last-second shot. And I believe that was the game that Isaiah Livers got hurt.
Yep, he got hurt in the second half of that game.
Yeah, so I feel like that probably swings the result of it if that doesn't happen.
Yeah, I would agree. It really was about as close as a game could possibly be. Michigan, you know, bricked a couple free throws. Io hit an impossible shot at the buzzer. Yeah, I mean, it was a tough outcome, but that doesn't really, you know, in terms of a potential rematch, I'm not as concerned. Plus, I mean, the time that they played in Champaign was back in December, so the teams have changed a lot since then.
Yeah, I'm not even really looking at that one to try to gather any sort of useful information. Real quick, should Michigan be so fortunate as to then advance to the title game, do you have kind of an opponent that you've been looking at the bottom end that you'd prefer to have come out? Obviously, once you reach the title game, there's not an easy out.
I would say Michigan State. Why not? Bring it on. Rubber match.
You know, I like that answer, because I think I'd prefer Michigan going against MSU's offense versus Maryland's in terms of not necessarily in terms of their like ceiling, but in terms of the fact that Jalen Smith is a more difficult cover for Michigan centers than Tillman has been. It did seem like Michigan found a pretty good game plan for how to handle the Winston Tillman pick and roll the last time around. So I'd be pretty interested in seeing a rubber match. And I don't think it's, even though the conference is pretty close this year, I'd be a little surprised if Purdue, Ohio State, or Penn State made a run out of the bottom end of that bracket. There's just going to be too many difficult games in too short a time.
Yep. Yeah, it should be interesting. I went to the Big Ten tournament a couple years ago. I was in the stands for John Teske's dunk against Isaac Haas. I was in the stands for Michigan's win over Michigan State in that tournament. It's a fun event. Like, if you ever get the chance to go, I would recommend it. You know, sit back, enjoy some basketball. Indy is a really a good location too. I was there for the Cam Chapman shot. You know, it's kind of a deep cut, but that was fun. I saw a lot of sad Indiana fans that day. It was great.
Yeah, I was there for the NCAA regional when Michigan played Oklahoma State and Louisville, and yeah, it's an awesome, awesome place for a weekend tournament, especially since kind of the whole downtown is interconnected. It's especially cool if you don't get the ideal weather. I've also been to the Big Ten tournament in Chicago. It's fun no matter where it is. I don't know if I would necessarily pick this year as the year, but you know, to each their own.
Get pretty cheap tickets due to the coronavirus, right?
That's probably true. You know, it certainly brought down the price of air travel. But anyway, real quick, let's put in some picks. What's your title game and who's your champion?
Man, putting me on the spot. I will, you know what? I will go with Michigan over Michigan State. I like the DNA of U of M's team. And even though there have been a couple of, let's say, troubling defensive performances in recent games, John Teske and Xavier Simpson on neutral floor, you can't bet against them.
That's I like the slight homer pick. I could very much see Michigan making a run. My fear is that they're going to have a game where they just cannot shoot. We've seen that a fair amount. And it's tough to get through a tournament when you have a clanger of a game, especially since there isn't going to be much of an ease up in this one. For my part, I will go with Iowa versus Maryland in the championship game, with Maryland taking it.
Interesting.
I'm not at all confident in that, but I wouldn't be at all confident picking this tournament. And anybody who says they would be is bluffing.
The only thing I'm fairly certain of is that Nebraska and Northwestern will not be advancing to Thursday.
Yes, and if they happen to advance to Thursday, they will certainly not be advancing to Friday.
And if they do advance to Thursday, there's going to be a lot of laughs at Archie Miller or Richard Pitino's expense.
Oh, if it happened to Archie Miller. Or, man, it would be so great if it happened to either of them.
Dude, I'm actually kind of worried that if Indiana tanks it here and misses the tournament and they get around to firing Archie, that, you know, there's a coach on the market who's had some success in the Big Ten, can really build a program, and knows Jerome Hunter.
You know.
So.
I'm not even going to acknowledge that that was said. I've heard it too much on the Main MGO podcast all year as Brian continues to speak it into existence.
Sorry, I just needle you a little bit. I don't think they will be firing Archie after this year.
And it's okay. We may or may not have a Beeline question coming up in the next segment. And speaking of which, let's get to that. So we're going to take a quick break, come back, and both of us will be answering some of your mailbag questions.
Will be replaced by a shiny new model.
Clear rock.
All right, our first question is from Twitter user at PSX120. The question, Michigan has been streaky all year. Are they good enough when they are on a hot streak to win either the Big Ten tournament and or March Madness? I have a feeling I know your answer to this, at least for the former, since you picked Michigan to win the Big Ten tournament.
You know, I think the thing is with Michigan, and this changed because of the Maryland outcome, but as of, you know, a couple of days ago, they were one of the few teams in college basketball to have a top 25 offense and defense, which is the marker of a future national champion. I think all but one in the last 15 years have had that. But senior point guard experience in terms of success, you know, each of the last 2 years, Michigan's been really good. I think they showed a really high ceiling earlier this season, and yeah, you know, if the threes are falling, who knows? I think it's kind of a wide open year in college basketball. It's kind of a wide open year in the Big Ten tournament, and maybe I'm just becoming more of an optimist, Ace. I don't know, but I could see it. Maybe not winning it all, but making a run, Sweet 16, maybe heartbreaker away from the Final Four. It's not too hard for me to picture. Yeah. Then again, the first round, who knows?
Yeah, no, I agree with you in terms of there's just so many potential outcomes for this team because they could shoot their way out of either tournament on day one. Or, you know, we've seen when this team actually is at full strength. I mean, Gonzaga is one of the few, like, consensus national title contenders out there. Michigan got them on a neutral court decisively. And that was while still figuring out a lot of roles for some of the younger guys on this team. So if we get, you know, a breakout from Franz or just decent, a return to form for Isaiah Livers to where he was at the beginning of the year, combined with, you know, healthy Eli Brooks, healthy Franz Wagner, they could definitely make a run. And, you know, this very well might be a year where you get that, like, that UConn run with Kemba Walker where somebody comes out of nowhere because there just aren't that many top tier teams this year.
Yeah, and I mean, Michigan should be what, like maybe a 7 seed?
I'd say probably, I would think they bottom out as a 6 seed, to be honest, unless they have a really poor showing in the Big Ten tournament.
Yeah, in that case, definitely a Final Four contender. And yeah, I mean, I already picked them to win the Big Ten tournament, not being a homer at all. So yeah, why not? Let's do it.
All right. The next one is kind of touches back on what we were going over in the last segment. Could you give a summary of this team's offensive philosophy and which teams in the tournament does it match up well against and which would be particularly troubling? That is an email from Brian. Not that Brian.
Not that Brian and not my Brian either. Yeah. I think to sum it up, ball screen heavy. Really ball dominant point guard, ball screen heavy. If somebody can take Xavier Simpson out of the game, Michigan will lose. I do think Jawan has really impressed me with the kind of sets that Michigan's been running. Like, there's quite a bit of offensive diversity, and the go-to sets tend to do pretty well. But ultimately, never play with the traditional four. Sometimes go five out. And I think in terms of which teams in the tournament does it match up well against and which would be particularly troubling, Michigan has a hard time defending stretch bigs, or has had a hard time in the Big Ten. So that, I guess, would be the biggest thing. But I would look for a team that, I like Michigan's style and how it matches up against theoretical opponents. I guess it's kind of hard for me because I don't know teams from other conferences that well to kind of throw out names of like, oh, well, Michigan would match up well against Baylor. Like, I don't know that, but
yeah, no, I haven't watched enough non-Big Ten basketball to give like an informed stylistic opinion on these other teams. I would describe Juwan Howard as like pro style, and I mean that in an extremely complimentary way, unlike if I said that for football, which is like the NBA is pretty ball screen heavy and incorporates a lot of the same sets that he has brought over to Michigan, which makes sense. He's been in the NBA for a quarter century and, you know, was, you know, working next to Eric Spoelstra, one of the better coaches in the NBA for a long time. And yeah, I'm a big fan of what he's brought over. I think teams Michigan would want to hunt with that would be like, I don't know, I think Illinois, because they don't have the best defensive big men. You know, putting those guys in ball screen situations and also working motion around them. And then Iowa, just because they're a crummy defensive team. But other than that, there isn't necessarily a team that I think you can really hunt among, like, the viable opponents that Michigan would play once they get past Rutgers, if that happens.
Yeah, and I will say that there seems to be a mindset among some college basketball fans who don't follow or don't like the NBA that they kind of just roll the ball out. But I think in terms of, you know, designing intricate or creative offenses, a lot of the best plays from the NBA tend to kind of trickle down, and Michigan runs some classic San Antonio Spurs stuff. Like you said, Eric Spoelstra, Miami Heat. If you do get a chance to watch the Heat, I would highly recommend it, not only for Duncan, but yeah, I mean, they're a fun team. But yeah, I think ball screen heavy, really, really reliant on Xavier Simpson. So if Michigan runs up against a theoretical team that has a really, really good defensive stopper on the perimeter, could be a big problem. But then again, you know, if he can kind of slice and dice ball screen situations with a poor defensive big man on the other side, I think Michigan will just get open looks all game long.
Yeah, I mean, like, it kind of just feels like Michigan wants, at least in terms of their offensive philosophy, you want to avoid really good defenses, which just seems like a general maxim that you'd want to follow. I don't think there's necessarily, like, I haven't seen, other than Wisconsin doing the, like, absolute no corners, no help defense, I'm not sure anyone's really incorporated a particularly unusual defensive approach in going against Michigan this year, or anything that took them out of their offense particularly. It hasn't felt like Michigan has gotten super bogged down against anybody. It's just a matter of, like, how good is the other team's center?
I will say that if I was an opponent, I would be running drop coverage against Simpson Teske ball screens and have Teske shoot 9 threes. And if he beats you, great. Yeah, but I assume that he wouldn't.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that. Speaking of centers, next question comes from at Dr. Garbs on Twitter. With Austin Davis coming back, who's the dark horse attrition candidate we're not thinking about?
Man, I, to be honest, I really hate speculation like this.
I wanted to get this question out here.
Yeah.
In large part because, like, I don't think there's a dark horse attrition candidate we're not thinking about. I think the way college basketball coaches operate is that you have a certain amount of scholarships, you stay within one or two of that line when you're recruiting, because you know, based on playing time, person's comfort with the university, person's relationship with the coaching staff, whatever. Early departures to the NBA, obviously. Michigan's experienced a decent amount of that. You're going to have attrition somewhere. So they decided that Austin Davis was good enough to come back. They have a number of options in terms of, first of all, we're not 100% sure that Isaiah Todd makes it to campus.
Same goes for Josh Christopher at this point.
I was about to say, we've been counting that chicken before it has hatched for a little while now, and especially with five-star recruitments, you never know. So I don't want to include him on next year's roster quite yet. And then you also have the possibility of Jace Howard coming in as a walk-on, and that's before you get to anybody transferring out. And obviously we've discussed that there are some rather apparent transfer candidates. I mean, between Adrian Nunez and Cole Bajima, there's probably a candidate there. And the other one I can think of is Colin Castleton, you know, kind of taking the Austin Davis return as a slight, especially in conjunction with Hunter Dickinson coming in. But I think there's very much a role for Castleton. He seems to be working hard. There hasn't been any word that he's been unhappy. So I think, you know, you go in, you have a certain likelihood of each individual player leaving, and all those add up to there's got to be space somewhere.
Yep. And in terms of dark horse attrition, like dark horse, because anybody who's not in the rotation right now but is on scholarship, anybody who may be in a more marginal role but still on scholarship, I think those would be candidates. I think the dark horse would be, so say Livers or Wagner puts their name into the NBA draft, does amazing in the pre-draft workouts, gets a promise from a team, that I could maybe see as a dark horse. I don't think either of those are likely to leave right now, but theoretically possible.
Yeah, no, and it is worth noting that this is a draft where there's, I would say, a lot of potential movement after the top 15 or so.
Even the top 15 is like pretty bad. I mean,
there's underwhelming top end talent. It's just there seems to be general agreement of at least like a top like 10 or so prospects, especially when you include a couple of the guys from Europe, that they're at least like going to be drafted somewhere in the top 20. But after you get past that, I mean, there are some drafts you see where like Cassius Winston's in the first round, and there are some where he's at the bottom of the second, because you really get very quickly to the point of there's going to be a split on whether these, whether front offices even think these guys are viable rotation players.
I forget which draftnik I saw say this, and I mean, it's probably a pretty common sentiment, but once you get outside of like the top 15 or 20, it really is all personal preference. And like, what guy do we think will fit in our system, or who can we develop? Who knows? Maybe Livers or Wagner. What I wonder for next year is how the minutes on the wing are going to shake out. And I know we don't have time for that question, but you look at Livers, Wagner, Todd, and Johns. That's four guys and starter minutes at two positions. I don't know. We'll see.
It gets tough very quickly, so we'll see. I mean, maybe that partially gets answered by off-season attrition, but hopefully not.
Yeah, and I didn't want to bring up Johns as a transfer candidate in terms of, like, he's developed well this year and really is showing some promise, seems to be putting it together in a more limited role, but he very much got recruited over, so, yeah.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, it can always be a little bit of a surprise in basketball in the off season, so I think the main takeaway from this is that I wouldn't worry about any sort of scholarship crunch next year. Next question is from Jeep and Ben. This is the question I didn't want to get to. So it was Brian's hot take, and I got to work in the middle of it. But could John Beilein have a role in the athletic department next year? As what? Watch film as an analyst, assistant? That's where the question ends. I have the quick answer. The quick answer is no.
I have a really hard time seeing him come back to college basketball without being a head coach. He's never been anything but a head coach. That was like the top factoid for any TV broadcast I watched in Michigan for years and years.
Yeah, John Beilein is not going to be anybody's analyst or assistant at this point. He doesn't seem like somebody who'd want to deal with the BS of taking on an administrative role in an athletic department if he decides that he doesn't want to coach anymore. I'd also be very surprised if he's done coaching. So, yeah, he can wait and pretty much have his pick of whatever top-tier college jobs come open.
So is Texas back? I know that's a college football bit, but, like, is Texas back? Is he going to be Texas's head coach?
It seems like one of the more likely destinations, other than the fact that it seems like an unusual, it would seem like an unusual culture fit, I would say, but just in terms of it's a location well outside where he's been before. But that was also the case with West Virginia and then Michigan. So he's clearly been more willing to branch out as his career has gone on.
And I've kind of believed that like the most underrated jobs in college basketball are the college football powerhouses that can throw money at it, and you'll get support if you're good, but if you're bad, people aren't as mad than, like, say, I mean, Indiana. I think Ohio State is a better basketball job than Indiana, frankly.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't necessarily disagree with you. And, I mean, you go back, I don't think anybody thinks Rick Barnes is some sort of basketball genius, but he had a Final Four team in there. He had four different top 10 finishes on KenPom. Make that five. Only missed the tournament once in a tenure that stretched from 1999 to 2015. So Smart has been a significant drop off from that, and there's plenty of room for Texas to bounce back up.
I will say that I don't think Beilein will go back into the Big Ten.
I hope you're right.
I really hope I'm right too, but I find that hard to, like, I don't know.
I don't know what jobs are necessarily going to come open, because firing Archie Miller this early would be expensive. And also, he has improved them just enough this year where it might be kind of tough to justify that, unless you've got Beilein, like, in hand.
Right.
And Beilein is a much older guy. Like, do you want to boot a guy who was, until very recently, a very promising young coach for someone who's clearly nearing the end of his career and isn't going to be around for that long? I guess it depends on where you're at. But, like, yeah, do I see Beilein taking the Northwestern job? No.
Yeah. I think Northwestern and Minnesota are the only ones going to potentially come open.
Yeah, and I believe Richard Pitino has been extended enough times that that would also be an expensive proposition for Minnesota as well.
Yeah, I need to get a good agent. I need to get Pitino's agent.
We all went into the wrong line of work.
We really did.
I should have been learning X's and O's about basketball from the time I was 4 years old. I blame my parents.
You should have been the child of a Hall of Fame basketball coach.
That's really where I went wrong. All right, last question before we get out of here. This is a fun one. It's also a kind of long one, so buckle up. I was recently trying to explain to some friends how much I hate floor slaps as a defensive basketball ritual. As you know, floor slaps are very bad. There's nothing quite as satisfyingly predictable as watching a non-Michigan player immediately get torched after slapping the floor on defense. In trying to justify my claim, though, I found myself insufficiently equipped with proper evidence. Where do I find the most convincing evidence of our claim that floor slaps are bad? Are there stats on this? A video compilation of floor slap fails? A Twitter thread? A series of GIFs? Do you keep a list of your top floor slap mishaps? Where do I find them? Please help me get to the juice of this topic. I cannot deal with having people around me who think floor slaps are acceptable. Also, do you have any psychological theories on why floor slaps suck so hard? What do they do to defenders' brains that immediately renders them destined to get totally cooked? Thanks for your help, Spike. It is not that Spike. So obviously there's a lot there. I will say that for the most convincing evidence, go to Twitter, type in Chris Vanini's Twitter handle, and
say
words
that.
Floor
yep.
slap. Because they're going to be followed by layup so often that you will get why people hate them. But also, this stretches back. Michigan fans mostly associate this with Michigan State, and particularly with the 2013 game when they had a floor slap sequence directly leading to points, and then Trey Burke and the rest of the team mocked their floor slapping by doing it themselves, which was amazing, as long as you only do it once. But the origin of this, as far as I know, is Duke, and that's why
yep.
everybody hates it.
Yep. Yeah, floor slapping is not a Michigan State thing. It's a Duke thing. I know as Michigan fans, we can kind of be a little Big Ten centric. I mean, that's true of me for sure. As for why they suck so hard, I don't know that there ever could be any evidence that you're more likely to give up a bucket after you slap the floor. I don't know that it does anything to the defender's brains more than that it just takes them out of position momentarily. Like, they're not, I mean, I don't know. Slapping the floor, they're not looking up at the ball.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem like one of those, I mean, it happens in moments where passions are starting to run high, and I think sometimes when you start playing a little too emotionally, you can kind of forget, like, oh right, I need to be in the right place. So part of it's that. Part of it might just be karmic retribution for stealing a thing from Duke and thinking it's cool, because I certainly don't want to model myself after Steve Wojciechowski as a basketball player. especially if I'm going for like, I look cool. And the floor slap is supposed to be like this intimidating thing, and it is a whack Duke thing. So that to me is just like, I don't know if I can explain it. I know based on just my lying eyes that floor slapping inevitably leads to a layup if you're not Duke.
And for the canonical example, I would suggest Googling Jay Sean Tate floor slap. The fact that I remember this really almost uncomfortably hammers home how much Big Ten basketball I've consumed over the last decade, that I take this out from memory and just totally. But yeah, he gets absolutely fried after he slaps the floor, and like the guy starts driving by him as he's not even looking, and really, really sums it up. So kind of a deep cut. I don't know what my life would be like if I was paying attention to other things as much as I've paid attention to Big Ten basketball. I find that it's like kind of a weird esoteric hobby, but yeah, I guess it gets me invited on podcasts sometimes, so it's worth it.
Certainly, yeah. And on that note, thank you very much for joining the podcast, Alex. It's all the questions we have, and it is now 10 o'clock on a Monday, so I think it's probably about time to wrap up recording. Especially if I want to get this out before the morning. So thank you, Alex, for joining the Ace Pod and turning it into a college-centric, not just a shooter episode. It's always great to have you on, man.
Always good to be here, and yeah, good to chop it up with you as always. Let's do it again soon sometime.
Most definitely. All right, thanks again to Alex Hook for joining me on today's Ace Pod. That is it for this week's episode. Should be back soon. Thank you, as always, to the law offices of E. Jason Blankenship for sponsoring the podcast, and hope everybody has a great tournament week.